When you were growing up, how you made your way, how you came to understand who you were and how you wanted to express that.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, it was difficult. I didn't have a lot of outlets. One of the things I found great solace in was Pokemon. It's a role-playing game, and you can choose to be a boy or a girl. Similarly, other role-playing games were refuges for me, online spaces where I could express myself as a boy, and then just a masculine identity that I carried with me throughout childhood that allowed me, in some degree, to be comfortable and do things I enjoyed doing and dress the way I enjoyed dressing. But it wasn't easy. I was still forced to behave and essentially be raised as a girl.
And so when did that change? And what message do you have to parents for trans kids?
Well, it especially started changing around puberty. My anxiety grew, my dysphoria, which is the feeling that your sexual characteristics, primary or secondary, don't match your brain. That grew. So there's a lot of extra stress and distress during that period of time, and so I really started expressing myself more firmly as a masculine individual. And then once I learned what transgender meant, I pretty quickly established that that was who I was. And that I came out when I was 14, and I would say to other trans youth, of course, be careful. It might not be safe for everybody to come out where they are. Some people might be at risk of violence or being cast out by their families. But there is a future for you in which you can live as who you are.
We will have to leave it there, Gavin. I want to thank you, Gavin Grimm, and Chase Strangeau for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the premier screening of Precipice Award-funded animation project, Jen Likes Heroin, on Thursday, March 9th at 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Jen Likes Heroin is an animated short film which takes place at the long-defunct X-Ray Cafe. Following the animation, there will be a showing of the documentary about the X-Ray Cafe called X-Ray Visions, and a short acoustic set by Sean Krogan of The Pinnacles and Cracker Bash. Again, that's a screening of X-Ray Visions and Jen Likes Heroin and a live performance by Sean Krogan on Thursday, March 9th at 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune into KBOO Wednesday, March 8th for International Women's Day.
We'll be celebrating all day long with special programming focusing on feminism, intersectionality, gender illusions,
and women in jazz, reggae, punk, and metal.
And so much more. That's International Women's Day. 24 hours of programming by women-identified folks for you.
Here at your community radio station,
KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And the time is now 5:02 p.m. That means it's time for your community-produced evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Advocacy groups in Washington state are calling for full FBI investigation into the death of a Muslim teen outside of Seattle.
A Jewish center in Portland received a bomb threat last night.
And tomorrow is International Women's Day.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. I'm Joe Lino.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. On Monday evening, Portland police officers responded to an email bomb threat at the Middleman Jewish Community Center in Southwest Portland. Several officers walked through the building with employees and did not find any suspicious items requiring a bomb squad response. The Portland Police Bureau is investigating and has communicated with federal law enforcement regarding the incident. The police bureau stated that it's not known if the threat in Portland is connected with other incidents across the country. Just this year, there have been more than 100 bomb threats to Jewish community centers and schools around the country.
A U.S. national of Indian origin who says a man shot him in the arm and told him to go back to his country is recovering at home in suburban Seattle. Deep Rai, 39, told police a stranger came up to him Friday night as he worked on his car in his driveway. They briefly argued, then the suspect told Rai to go back to his homeland and shot him in the arm. Police in the city of Kent are investigating the Friday night shooting as a hate crime, and the FBI has joined the investigation. The shooting has rattled members of the Sikh community, which numbers about 50,000 in Washington state. The Sikh temple in nearby Renton, where the victim has worshipped for about a decade, leaders told the faithful to keep calm and pray. Many in the Seattle area Sikh community have said they're scared to go home or scared to go to the store and other public places. Some noted an increase in name-calling and other racist incidents in recent months.
A report stating that Uber used a secret program to tip the scales against city regulators in Portland in 2014 has riled city officials. The New York Times reported Sunday on an Uber program called Grayball that could identify city regulators in order to circumvent local investigations. It could direct drivers to avoid picking them up, all the while showing non-existent Uber cars in the area. Mayor Wheeler and Transportation Commissioner Saltzman this afternoon announced that the launch of a city investigation into the practice. Officials noted that city rules mandate that so-called transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft accept, quote, any request for service received from any location within the city, end quote. Cherry-picking users that drivers should avoid would fly in the face of that requirement.
The Portland Bureau of Transportation activated its two newest speed safety cameras yesterday. They are the first such cameras in East Portland, and both are located on Southeast Division Street. One camera is at the intersection of 122nd Avenue, the other at 151st Avenue. Crash data analysis revealed that more vehicle-related injuries and deaths occur on Southeast Division than any other street in Portland. The speed camera activation follows a recent speed limit reduction from 35 miles an hour to 30 miles an hour along that stretch of road. PBOT said the cameras are set to photograph and videotape vehicles traveling faster than the speed limit. During the first 30 days of operation, drivers caught exceeding the speed limit by the cameras will be given warnings. After the warning period ends on April 4th, speeders will be issued citations. The typical speeding citation in Oregon results in a $160 fine.
Retired attorney George Windmeyer filed suit against the city of Portland in 2013, arguing its arts tax was unconstitutional. Now he's arguing his case before the Oregon Supreme Court. Portland voters approved the tax in 2012, and taxpayers have been expected to pay it every year since, but many have refused. The court will decide whether the $35 per person annual tax violates Oregon's constitution, which prohibits a head tax. Although the state constitution does not give a clear definition of what a head tax is, both a trial court and the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that the arts tax is not a head tax. The city attorney argues that it's not a head tax because it doesn't apply to everyone. It exempts taxpayers earning under $100,000 and individuals and households below the federal poverty line. But Windmeyer argues that any tax applied uniformly is a head tax. Excusing one person who makes less does not create different tax brackets, he said. The state Supreme Court could take as long as from several months to a year to issue its decision.
International Women's Day is now celebrated in more than 100 countries around the world. It began as National Women's Day, with the first held in New York City on February 28, 1909, organized by members of the Socialist Party of America. Thousands of people turned out for various events and speeches. In 1911, the first true International Women's Day was held, drawing more than a million people to rallies worldwide. Marches and rallies even continued through World War I when most social reform events were halted. This year in the U.S., women plan to strike in what is being called a Day Without a Woman and is billed as a day of protest and advocacy for gender equality. In Ireland and the U.K., women will be also marching. Irish women plan to strike and protest the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which bans abortion. Last year in Poland, women took to the streets to also protest harsh abortion laws and plan to do the same this year. Women in Turkey defied a government ban on protesting in March this past Sunday, resulting in police firing rubber bullets into the crowd. In contrast, women in Italy will be given free entry to all the country's museums and cultural sites, which will be devoted to exhibits that celebrate the feminine world.
With International Women's Day tomorrow, many men are wondering what they can do to support it. KBOO's Al Khan has some thoughts on the subject.
I wish at this time to speak to all men, my brothers. When you walk down the street, do you ever see how women react to you? Or do you ever really see them at all, except their bodies and their pretty wrapping, while ignoring what's inside and hope one smiles and flirts? Do you see them as actual people with feelings and lives? Do you know how many women you pass by are scared of you simply because you are a man? Many of these women have been hurt physically and emotionally and have been left with scars that may never heal. It is time to open up a discussion, not with the women we know, but amongst ourselves. Yes, you may be one of the nice guys, but how many women actually know this? Probably only the ones that you are close to in your lives. Even coworkers and other women you know casually may see you as a threat. We must start to learn that our words and actions have an impact. We must start to think of these words and actions, no matter how frivolous we think they are. Words like baby, honey, darling may seem like nothing to you, but to a woman who's heard this many, many times a day, it gets old and even hurtful. Remember, one small drop of water on your forehead isn't anything, but if you are tied down and cannot escape, by the time 100 drops of water hit your forehead, you are starting to get angry, maybe a little crazy. That's called torture. How many times a day do women hear these words? Do you think a casual touch on a woman's arm is nothing? To a woman that has been abused, it could be a reminder of that. And so, my brothers, let's talk amongst ourselves. If you see another man behaving in a manner that might be inappropriate, say something. Remember, these women are our sisters, our mothers, our daughters, our aunts, our grandmothers. To end this, we must start with ourselves. I'm Al Khan. Thank you for your attention.
That was KBOO's Al Khan on what men can do to be in support of women.
The federal case against four defendants charged with conspiring to impede federal employees from doing their work at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge through intimidation, threat, or force is complete. The manager of the refuge and its former fish biologist returned to the witness stand Tuesday to testify about the fears they felt during the armed takeover of the bird sanctuary. Manager Chad Carges said he placed loaded guns at every door of his home based on what he knew of the Bundy family standoff with the federal agents in Bunkerville, Nevada in 2014. Carges says he didn't feel comfortable reporting to work at the refuge after the seizure by Bundy and his followers because of the presence of armed guards in the refuge. In response to threats from the occupiers, Carges ordered his staff to evacuate from Harney County. The government finished calling rebuttal witnesses and rested its case shortly after the refuge employees' testimony. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ethan Knight then delivered his closing argument.
A 223-mile-long underground pipeline has been proposed by the company Williams Pacific Connector Gas Operator to transport natural gas from Coos Bay to the California border just south of Klamath Falls. The route of the pipeline would require a 100-foot-wide corridor to be clear-cut during the entire length of the project to allow for the machinery necessary to build the and bury the 36-inch pipeline. 153 miles of the route is planned to be on private land, affecting thousands of people. If there is a case of someone not wanting the pipeline to go through, their property, their company, the company will still have the ability to seize the land, as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will allow Williams to acquire the land through eminent domain. The planned route of the pipeline would have it crossing streams, which are home to both salmon and steelhead, running along with seven rivers in southern Oregon. The heavy equipment used to build a project of this size would damage stream beds in some of the most sensitive salmon spawning areas in the Northwest. The Bureau of Land Management is already allowing construction companies to sail out the proposed route on the ground. This involves cutting trees and using equipment that is disruptive to many sensitive species, such as the spotted owl and bald eagle. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is asking for comments that will be considered when writing an environmental impact statement. To make a comment, go to the FERC website at www.ferc.gov. The deadline for comments is July 24th.
President Donald Trump signed a new version of his controversial travel ban Monday and cited a foiled bomb plot in Portland as part of the justification for the proposed action. Trump's executive order temporarily shuts down the U.S. refugee program and bans travel into the country from six Muslim-majority nations. In justifying the ban, it cites the Somali Americans' failed 2010 plot to detonate a car bomb at a Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland as a reason some immigrants are threats to national security. Mohammed Mahmoud, who came to the U.S. as a child, was convicted in 2014 of plotting to use a car bomb. The car he thought was packed with explosives was actually full of dummy bombs provided by undercover federal agents. The order revokes Trump's first travel ban and substitutes a narrower version. The reversion still bans immigration from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, but removes Iraq from the original list. A 90-day travel restriction from those countries does not apply to people with already approved visas or U.S. green cards. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden said the new order is, quote, little more than a warmed-over rehash of the original. It is barely a disguised religious ban that will do absolutely nothing to protect our country, end quote.
The unsolved death of a Muslim teenager in Washington state has advocacy groups demanding a full federal investigation. KABU reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Ben Keita, an 18-year-old from Lake Stevens, Washington, went missing last November 26th. On January 9th of this year, his body was found hanging from a tree in Lake Stevens, and his death was ruled a suicide. Keita, a Muslim, is described by his father as, quote, a very happy young man, and had no history of depression, anxiety, or any psychological breakdown. At a press conference hosted by the Washington chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, Ben's father Ibrahima Keita said that Ben had been enrolled in the Running Start program at Everett High School. His dream was to become a medical doctor. Last month, after reviewing the evidence, Snohomish County officials changed Ben Keita's cause of death from suicide to undetermined, drawing the attention of faith and civil rights groups all over the country. Despite the change, the Lake Stevens police closed their investigation of his death last week, claiming they fully investigated. Since then, CARE Washington and other groups have called on the FBI to fully investigate Keita's death to find out if there was foul play involved and if it could be considered a hate crime. Some in the greater Seattle area have made connections to the way lynchings in the U.S. were often misidentified, on purpose or not, as suicides. Reverend Kelly Brown, for example, of Seattle's Plymouth Congregational Church, quoted on KIRO Seattle, said these mischaracterizations were the result of incomplete investigating by authorities. Today at 6:30 p.m., a vigil is being held at Red Square in the University of Washington in Seattle in memory of Keita. It was organized by CARE Washington as well as the UW Black Student Union and the Somali Students Association. The groups say they will reiterate their call for the FBI to fully investigate the case. For its part, the FBI issued a statement on Friday agreeing with the Lake Stevens police that, quote, evidence collected to date does not provide any indication of a criminal act. However, the Bureau also said it would reevaluate its position as new evidence came forward. As of this broadcast, the FBI has not changed its position. For more on this story, I spoke with CARE Washington's Executive Director Arsalan Bukhari on Friday.
And can you just first tell me a little bit about who was Ben Keita?
Well, Ben Keita was an all-American child. He was born and raised in the Seattle area. He was taking Running Start classes while he was going to high school. So he was enrolled in Lake Stevens High School and at the same time was taking Running Start classes at Everett Community College. So he was slated to graduate this coming June with college credit. And, you know, parents are really just, again, an all-American family, mom and dad, three kids, including Ben. His other two siblings were born in the Lake Stevens area. They've been living in Lake Stevens for about 17 years, they said, and they have been in the Seattle area for about, well, more than 2 decades, since 1995. So U.S. citizens, the parents are registered voters. They are, you know, Lake Stevens is the area that they know, that children know, and this was their home.
And just briefly, what happened to him in the last few months?
Yeah, so well, so Ben went missing on November 26th, and then his body was found hanging from a tree on January 9th by some young people who were hanging out in the woods. And these are not woods in a rural area. They're next to a housing development, like many suburban areas have a number of homes and then kind of trees around the backyard. So that's kind of how this was. And the manner in which his body was found was very alarming. It was hanging from a tree, from a rope, and you know, this young man is about 18 years old, and that's what we know. The parents have been working with the police for many months since he went missing. We have been contacted by the family after he was found on January 9th, and then we have been working and have been in touch with the family and the law enforcement since then to ensure a comprehensive investigation. Because more than a month has passed and there remain many questions and many leads unpursued, we asked for the FBI to then consider taking on a full investigation so that they can use their expertise, experience, and human resources to conduct a comprehensive investigation. And I think the greatest hope of the family is that someone out there has some knowledge of the circumstances or perhaps any people involved in this, and that they will come forward and report that to the FBI Seattle office or to police simply by calling 911. I mean, we really are relying and hoping for members of the public who may have any knowledge to come forward and report anything they might know.
Of course, there's a lot of news across the country about attacks on immigrants and people of Muslim faith. And is there any indication at this time that this could be any sort of incident like that?
That's a good question. So we just don't know at this time what led to his death, what motive anyone had in leading up to his death. We just don't have any of that information yet. So that's why we're hoping for a full comprehensive investigation so that we can get the family can get some answers around what may have led to the death of their son, and so that they can have some closure as well. So a full comprehensive investigation, we believe, will hopefully uncover many more facts that can tell the family what may have led to their son's death.
And you may have touched on this briefly, but have you received any response from the FBI yet or the federal government?
And so we received a response, and they said they're reviewing the case. So they're reviewing the case, and they haven't opened a full investigation, but we've asked them to open a full investigation and dedicate their resources because this case is so important and a very serious case.
Just to be clear, his death is currently ruled as undecided, right?
It was ruled by the Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office as undetermined. And the reason why they mentioned that is important. They mentioned that that this was a manner of death because of a couple of factors. Number one, that there were some search and rescue efforts that were launched immediately after, or a few days after, he was found missing. And those rescue efforts didn't result in him being found. In fact, the last rescue effort was on December 7th, but then he was found on January 9th. Hanging from a tree in the woods. And so that was one thing. The other, and that, of course, has many possibilities. The other reason they stated in their opinion as to why the manner of death they concluded was undetermined is that the rope was strung across, strung on a branch that was about 50 feet high off the ground. And the young man was just hanging with his feet about 2.5 feet above the ground. It was a very long rope, and you know they just can't conclude who could have done this. Actually changed their determination from suicide to undetermined because of all these factors that they learned about, and because the family had contacted them to figure out, you know, what they think the manner of death.
What has the response been in the community of Lake Stevens?
Yeah, well, I think the family has mentioned that. Some of the neighbors have come forward and expressed their condolences. But, you know, the bottom line is if the best way to help is for good people, fair-minded, everyday people, as well as leaders, so echo the public call for the FBI to investigate this. We're hoping that, you know, our state's governor, state lawmakers, and U.S. Congress members will also send their own inquiries to the FBI and ask them to conduct a full comprehensive federal investigation so that the FBI is motivated to take this on as a full investigation.
Oh, and I guess that brings up, has anybody, any other groups or people signed on to this request with you?
So when we first issued this request back on Monday, we sent a letter to the FBI this past Monday. The next day we held a press conference, and in that press conference we had the Faith Action Network, which is a coalition of many churches across the state of Washington. The Faith Action Network also issued a call, and they had their co-director, Elisa Guir, who joined us and stated the call for the FBI to investigate this on behalf of the Faith Action Network. We also had the executive director of the Church Council of Greater Seattle, Mr. Michael Ramos, and he also made a public call for the FBI to investigate this. And lastly, we also had Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown, who is the associate pastor at Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ here in Seattle, and she also made that call. So at least three leaders have done that right on the day of the press conference, and I think many more will be doing the same in the coming days as well.
Arslan Bukhari, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for your attention to this case. Really appreciate it.
I've been speaking to Arslan Bukhari, the executive director of the Washington chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
The FBI has not responded to a request for comment in time for broadcast. Anyone with information about Ben Kata's disappearance or death is asked to call the FBI Seattle field office at 206-622-0460. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Transpositive PDX at 6. At 7 is Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather, expect more rain showers throughout the day with a high of 49 degrees and a low of 44. East of the Cascades, expect a mostly cloudy day with a chance of showers with highs in the mid-40s and lows around 35. Today in history, in 1927, a Texas law that banned African Americans from voting was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. The quote of the day is from Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, quote, "I have come to see more and more that one of the most decisive steps that a Negro can take is that little walk to the voting booth. That is an important step. We've got to gain the ballot, and through that gain, political power," unquote.
It's 5:27. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Trump and company claim to have a sweeping mandate from voters. But wait, almost half of the electorate chose not to vote last November. Only 25% of voters actually cast their ballots for Trump. 26% chose Clinton. 60% of those who did vote for Trump said they don't trust him. Some mandate. Here's another fact. Those of us fighting for populist justice are stronger than we've been in decades. But how can that be since Trump is in the White House? Because the vast majority of people agree with the ideals and ideas of progressive populism, not with Trumpism. Even most of his supporters were not voting for what they're about to get, a plutocratic, autocratic agenda that'll steamroll the working class and poor. Trump was not elected on issues, but on anger. A lot of Trump voters simply heard him speaking one truth repeatedly. The system is rigged by and for the elites. That's true. So the riggies, furious at being flattened by the corporate and political powers, saw Trump as a big Bodark stick that they could grab to thump the whole smug establishment upside its collective head. However, far from alleviating their anger and despair, Trump is already betraying them, as revealed by the actual proposals he's making and the people he's brought inside the White House. Remember his promise to drain the swamp in Washington? Instead, he's filled it with a new slew of creepy, crawly swamp creatures like Jeff Sessions, Steve Mnuchin, Rex Tillerson, Tom Price, Scott Pruitt, Betsy DeVos, and a mess of Wall Street insiders. These are career-long corporate hacks, not working-class champions. This is Jim Hightower saying, progressives not only need to resist the plutocratic agenda of these fraudsters, but also to put forth our true people's agenda and start rallying voters around it right now.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The Senate Judiciary Committee continued the confirmation process for high-level posts in the U.S. Department of Justice Tuesday with a joint hearing for Deputy Attorney General and Associate Attorney General nominee. The hearings come amid calls for an independent investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election and into apparently false statements made under oath by Attorney General Jeff Sessions during the confirmation hearings. Rue Packard, with our friends at Free Speech Radio News, has more.
The Senate Judiciary Committee questioned nominees for two high-level Justice Department posts Tuesday, including the nominee for the number two position. If confirmed, Maryland U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein would be responsible for leading any investigations into Russian interference in the presidential elections after Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself last week. Senator Dianne Feinstein quickly voiced concern about Justice Department actions already taken under the Trump administration, including the about-face on the Texas voter ID case and guidance for schools regarding how best to provide equal access to facilities for transgender students. But what the California Democratic ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee seemed most interested to know was if Rosenstein was prepared to appoint a special counsel to probe allegations that Russia manipulated the recent electoral process to swing the outcome in Trump's favor.
Now, given the recusal by the Attorney General and the intense political interest in this matter and the strong potential that the investigation will in fact involve individuals associated with the White House, it would seem that this situation also rises to the level of extraordinary circumstances that warrant a special counsel under the regulations. Given all of this and the heightened level of distrust on all sides, do you support the appointment of an independent special counsel to look into these matters?
Senator, my understanding of this, and again, it's based solely on media accounts at this point, my understanding is that at least one of your colleagues called for a special counsel for something related to this matter while Attorney General Lynch was in office in early January, and she rejected the request. And based on the media accounts, I believe she said exactly what I said, that she had confidence in the career professionals of the department. But she had an additional piece of information. She presumably knows the facts, and I didn't, and she rejected that request. Currently, Senator, we have an acting attorney general for this matter, Dana Bente. He was appointed U.S. attorney by President Obama, and if there were a need for a special counsel, he currently has full authority to appoint one. So I don't know at this point if Attorney General Lynch or acting Deputy Attorney General Bente are right or wrong, but I certainly wouldn't be in position to overrule them without having access to the facts that are the basis for their decisions.
So I'm trying to figure out what your bottom line is. I interpret that as a no. Is that fair?
Well, I don't know. Senator, I think the answer is I'm simply not in position to answer the question because I don't know the information that they know, the folks who are in the position to make that decision. And when I am in that position, I don't presume that Attorney General Lynch and Acting Deputy Attorney General Bente are correct. I have a lot of respect for them, but if I determine that they're mistaken, then I would overrule them.
Thank you. I understand.
Attorney General Sessions recused himself from any campaign-related probes after revelations that he held two meetings with a Russian envoy while serving as a campaign surrogate for then-candidate Donald Trump. During his confirmation hearings, then-Senator Sessions denied any such meetings, though later claimed that he misspoke. The Deputy Attorney General oversees the daily operations of the Justice Department, including the Solicitor General's Office and the Office of Legal Counsel, as well as law enforcement agencies like the FBI, the DEA, and the AFT. Rosenstein is a three-decade civil servant who has served under both Republican and Democratic administrations. The Bush appointee recently garnered headlines in Baltimore when he announced corruption charges against seven police officers on charges of racketeering, including extortion and robbery. Rachel Brand also took questions from the committee. Brand is the nominee for Associate Attorney General, and if appointed, would be in charge of civil litigation at the DOJ, overseeing the Civil Rights Division, the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, and the Office on Violence Against Women. The Senate Judiciary Committee is widely expected to advance both nominees. For FSRN, I'm Ro Packard.
Yesterday at a zoo near Paris, France, Vince, a four-year-old white rhino, was found dead by poachers. The animal was shot four times in the head, and his horn was removed with a chainsaw. The poachers broke into the zoo by forcing a grill near the rear entrance, then broke through two more locked doors to get into the rhino enclosure. Two other rhinos at the zoo, Gracie, age 37, and Bruno, age 5, were unharmed. Officials fear the poachers were planning to kill the other rhinos as well, but since Vince's second horn was not taken, they speculate they were either interrupted or had equipment failure. Vince was born at Burgers Zoo in the Netherlands and arrived in France in 2015. The zoo said he belonged to an extremely threatened subspecies of southern white rhinoceros. It is estimated that there are only about 21,000 white rhinos remaining in the wild worldwide.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. Troops invade areas in Gaza, injuring one farmer. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, troops detain seven civilians, including a child. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian young man was injured on Tuesday morning after Israeli soldiers, accompanied by tanks and bulldozers, invaded farmlands in northern Gaza and bulldozed them while firing live rounds and few shells. The Palestinian Health Ministry has reported that the Palestinian, 22 years of age, was injured by fragments of an artillery shell and was moved to the Indonesian hospital after suffering minor wounds. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers abducted Tuesday seven young Palestinian men and one child during clashes near Ofer Israeli prison built on Palestinian lands between Betunia town and Rafat village in the central West Bank district of Ramallah. The clashes started after the soldiers assaulted students protesting Monday killing of Basil al-Araj, and the soldiers fired many gas bombs, concussion grenades and rubber-coated steel bullets. The clashes extended to various areas surrounding the prison while the soldiers ambushed many protesters and chased them before abducting the eight Palestinians, including the child. Some of them were shot with rubber-coated steel bullets prior to the abduction. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers assaulted the abducted Palestinians before dragging them into the prison compound. In other news, Israeli troops closed on Tuesday all roads leading in and out of Beit Jala town near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. Israeli sources said that troops were deployed around the town after a settler was stabbed by a Palestinian at Settlers Road 60 on Tuesday. According to Israeli sources, the settler picked up a Palestinian from the side of the road when the latter attacked the Israeli settler, injuring him. Israeli army sources said that the settler sustained light wounds in his shoulder while the Palestinian fled the scene. Up until the time of this report, no further details were available. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, March 7th, 2017 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan, Tom Hoon, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Joe Lino. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zelis Marchant. And the Evening Public Affairs and Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Joe Lino. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, it's a 24-hour special programming event celebrating International Women's Day. The day will include discussions of transfeminism versus TERF, trans-exclusionary radical feminism, human trafficking, the Women's General Strike, and more, plus female musicians and vocalists. There'll be something for everyone in this all-day, all-night special produced entirely by female-identified volunteers at KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Have a good night, Joe.
Have a good night, Jen.
Hi, Wesley.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A merry-go-round that never stops. That's what a new report on the criminalization of mental illness by Disability Rights Oregon is called. It describes in depth the conditions and treatment that those in Multnomah County Jail who deal with mental health issues, health challenges face. KBOO's Kanan Schlesinger spoke with Sarah Radcliffe, who authored the report, to gain some insight into what she saw in her visits to Multnomah County Detention Center during her investigation.
Disability Rights Oregon is Oregon's federally designated protection and advocacy system, so we're a nonprofit that advocates for people with disabilities. My work focuses on mental health issues and institutions, and over the last however many 30, 40 years, as institutionalization has kind of crept from state hospitals more towards jails and prisons, and so protection and advocacy organizations across the country have followed their client constituencies to jails and prisons. Over the past 2 years, we have conducted a series of monitoring visits to jails around the state. And usually it's a two-day visit. We spend a day talking with administration and touring the jail and reviewing policies, and then a day having individual conversations with people who are incarcerated there. So we did one of those monitoring visits in Multnomah County, and the problems that occur in Multnomah County are certainly not unique. We decided to focus on Multnomah County for this report due to a number of factors, but these are problems that occur statewide.
And did you carry out any of these visits yourself? You are an attorney, so you do legal work for Disability Rights Oregon. Are you receiving most of this information secondhand, or were you there with those folks that were carrying out the visits, caseworkers, I imagine?
So I did all of these monitoring visits myself. Yeah, that's I consider that to be a really critical part of my job, is actually, going into the places where our clients live or are held and seeing the conditions firsthand and talking to them firsthand. My agenda is very much about getting that firsthand information.
And can you talk about some of the things that landed some of these individuals in jail, and just how their struggles with mental illness are being criminalized?
Sure. that was one of the big points that we wanted to make in this report, is that really it's a systems failure. We don't have the community mental health system and the other supports like housing that keep people stable in the community, and therefore they're doing behaviors that people with mental illness, you know, may tend to do in public spaces, and as a community we don't have a whole lot of tolerance for that. So police pick them up, law enforcement pick them up because there's some sort of situation that they view as untenable. Often it's not a criminal situation per se, and law enforcement may not have a stake in prosecuting a crime in order to protect public safety. A lot of times we see crimes like disorderly conduct, trespass, failure to appear, these small kind of nuisance crimes. But law enforcement don't have a whole lot of alternatives to jail. There aren't a lot of resources and places where, you know, alternative destinations. And so that's kind of the dynamic that funnels people into the criminal justice system, really because of behaviors related to mental illness.
Can you speak to the what the report refers to as the jail's flawed continuum of care, and how inmates are treated with isolation, discipline? You mentioned force and deprivation.
So what we refer to as the jail's flawed continuum of care is the fact that in the absence of a strong clinical presence, that the tools that deputies have at their disposal are corrections tools. And the stark reality of that is that behavior that's related to mental illness, when it happens in jail, is usually met with use of force, violence, putting a spit sock on somebody's head, putting them in a restraint chair, maybe using a taser, putting them in conditions of extreme isolation and sensory deprivation, solitary confinement, suicide.